Anna. Hi, Sam. Thanks for coming to the Living Poets Show. Today we're going to talk about the fact that we're all independent publishers and what that means about our relationship to the media and broadcasting.
That cool. Sounds good. Do you think that we are independent, actually?
I don't know. What do you think, Sam?
I'm not sure. I mean, obviously, we're in a relationship with people who read our books and buy our books, we hope, or, you know, something like that. Like, there's something we exist within that is cooperative.
No, I guess that begs the question, what does independent mean? I guess it's traditionally taken to mean independent from corporate sponsorship, right? That's what we think of when we say independent, or also independent from institutional sponsorship.
Yeah, it is a good question. I would say it's more not so much about sponsorship, because most independent presses get some kind of sponsorship from institutions or whatever, but independently run, so that the editorial decisions are not beholden to any kind of corporate or institutional sponsorship. But who knows? That's just what I think.
Well, I think also that
you guys
idea of
let's back it up a minute. I love that we started in media res. We are coitus interruptus.
So should we kill that and start?
No,
from
we
a
can.
Fresh
we can. I mean, no. I like for the Living Poets Show. I like things to be spontaneous.
Well, the one thing I was going to say is independent also strikes me. One aspect of it is to be pioneering, to be maverick, to be independent, to be standing.
Like
out.
Do you mean American spirit? What? Yeah, you're talking. Are you talking
you
about being, manifesting our destiny?
Great,
is that what you're talking
about? The Great Pumpkin.
But I suppose, well, this brings us right into a question that I wanted to ask you both to basically describe the structures of your organizations, which I think, bears on the question of what does it mean to be independent. But so first, let me ask you each, and I will also introduce yourselves. I'll go first. I'm Rebecca Wolf. I'm the host of the Living Poets Show. This is a special edition of the Living Poets Show for the Fund Drive week, the Pledge Drive. And so I'm really hoping that those of you who are listening will call in and pledge to your local independent radio station that you need so much. And the theme of the pledge drive is Be Your Media. So that's another thing we'll discuss here today. Are we being our media? Are we the media? I am a publisher and an editor, but here I'm talking about the publishing aspect of what I do. I run a press called Fence Books, and I also publish the literary journal Fence, which comes out twice a year. And we publish about 6 to 8 books a year by poets mostly, although we also publish fiction and some critical texts. My press began very independently in that I began it like with no sponsorship. So literally, you know, I didn't have a funder. I just had the funds that we raised through events and various things just like this, actually, benefits. So then years later, I became affiliated with the University at Albany. So that's the independence of money. And then there's the question of who constitutes the community of your publishing, and how are you working? Are you working independently as sort of a kingpin publisher or not? And so let's ask Anna Moskovakis to talk about herself.
Hello, I'm Anna Moskovakis. I am one of the members of the Ugly Duckling Press Collective, which is a publishing process. It's a process, but it's sort of a publishing project that's been going on for over 12 years. It began as the Ugly Duckling zine back in the 90s when Matvey Yankelevich, one of the founding editors, had this zine called the Ugly Duckling. And after he moved to New York, he kind of gathered around himself a number of people, visual artists, performing artists, and writers who wanted to do something together. And it was actually not specifically focused on becoming a small press at all in the beginning. It was focused on the book and an idea of the book and a question about what the book is that kind of went beyond the normal ideas of that. So there were lots of one-of-a-kind books printed on untraditional types of material exchanged between the members of this collective in the beginning. And there were performances that were called paperless books, and there were anti-readings, which were kind of an antidote to the conventional poetry reading. So there'd be these sort of carnivalesque experiences where people would do things with poetry to share them with a public that were different from just standing up and reading them from a book, reading their poems from a book. So all of these things kind of coalesced and other people joined. I joined in 2002 and the collective continued to grow, and there are now about 13 of us, and we are volunteer editors, and we are all publishers, we're all editors, we're all designers, and we run a little bit like a small press in that over the last 10 years we've sort of started to put out regular books with spines that you can get in bookstores and that get reviewed in regular media outlets. We also continue the handmade book tradition by making a lot of chapbooks, smaller edition handbound books. And we operate a lot like a small press, but internally we operate like a kind of anarchic collective. And we don't have any specific corporate or institutional sponsorship. We are independent in that sense. But we do get about a third of our funding from grants, and a lot of those grants come from the government. So that's institutional and perhaps also corporate, depending on your point of view.
Right. Well, that's, yeah, I'd love to get back to this, the question of you spoke about how at the beginning your interaction with your audience really had to do with actual events even, or so there's really a very direct relationship with who your reader is and how you're reaching them. And so I'm curious to hear both all of us talk a little bit about how that has evolved and since basically the internet, and how that also can be talked about in contrast with this radio station, actually, which is, you know, independent local media and which has this very specific broadcasting range. So Sam Truitt is here as well, and he's going to talk about Station Hill Press.
Yeah, my name's Sam Truitt, and I'm managing director of Station Hill Press, and happily, and I published a book with Ugly Duckling, so I can attest to you know, the fantasticness of what you do. And I also remember those anti-readings were terrific, and I think that they are very much related to opening up a faces of what it is to be literate and to be in the way in which being literate is evolving. But Station Hill Press of Barrytown, 32 years old, started by George and Susan Quasha in Barrytown, New York, south of Bard, south of Hudson, in Dutchess County. It was coincident. George had been very active in New York, publishing Charles Olson, working at Stony Brook as a professor, and also with John Cage doing different things, and then moved to Barrytown and started the press ostensibly because his friends needed jobs, and George had a capacity to make things happen and to make structures, which he did in the form of Station Hill as well as Open Studio, which was situated in Rhinebeck at where the Terrapin Restaurant is now, that old church.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. At one point, there were 41 people working for Station Hill.
Wow.
And yeah, George had a real facility for securing state and national funds, which, you know, certainly in the 80s was sort of in a full cycle, and then in the 90s, you know, began to slack off. And now, I mean, we're really in a low ebb of the kind of independent, per se, public funding through the state and the U.S. At this juncture, we have about 241 books that we've published. At this juncture, though, we're down to publishing about 6 to 8 books, like you, Rebecca. And we don't have any real exterior funding. We had NISCA grants. I mean, I've done this for 2 years. I used to work in publishing in New York. I used to have a public relations company in publishing.
And just for those of you who are listening, NISCA is the New York State Council on the Arts.
Right. Thank you. And so, yeah, we're just operating off of sales through our backlist and through some contributions, but
It is funny how we can just really directly speak about funding, since this is a pledge drive, and it has really turned into a situation where any kind of arts organization cannot really expect significant support. I mean, you can still get it, but it's just not the kind of, you know, mainstay that it once was. And so there is this sense that we must turn to individuals for funding. And so that establishes this direct relationship again with the audience, I guess, is what it is, which is very much what GXC is talking about with this pledge drive, because there's the Be Your Media slogan, and then there's the Own Your Media slogan. So anyway, that's a funny thing when you're talking about publishing books, which are a commodity which can be purchased. And so the support can come in that form. It can come through people just, you know, actually going out and buying or staying in and buying your product.
Yeah, I was just going to say something similar, but I think the thing that maybe isn't intuitive, but that we understand because we work with the book, small press runs of the book, is that, you know, making books, like the price of a book, the purchase price of a book is more or less set by the market, which is more or less set by books that are printed in many, 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 many copies, which allows the cost to the publisher to go way, way down. Mm-hmm. There's something about the type of publishing that we all do, where I'm assuming you guys probably do print runs of 1,000 to 2,000,
yeah,
or even less than
absolutely
that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There's something just about the numbers that makes it fairly impossible to support that enterprise simply by sales, especially if you have any paid employees whatsoever. And that's just this weird quirk of what we do, that we're constantly asking for money. Those of us who are a nonprofit, Ugly Duckling is a nonprofit, so we're a registered charity. And it's just odd to be asking people.
Hill.
Okay, so we're all registered charities, and we're asking people to give some of their allocated charitable contributions to us.
Right.
But we also go out and sell things, and
right,
most charities don't. So it's an odd situation to be in. And it's like, as good as we may be at selling our books, we probably still would not be able to support the kind of staff that we could use or anything. So
I really
we're
wonder
in this
at
weird
what point.
Catch 22.
Yeah, at what point did this become like, it's a chicken and egg situation in terms of how presses, maybe just, I don't, I'll just speak about poetry presses, but how we present ourselves as being unviable, essentially.
Yeah.
Like, and I know that another publisher, Wave Books, I think they in the last 10 years, found a publisher, so a, you know, a man of wealth who sponsors the publication. But part of, I think, his goal for them was that they would throw off that notion, you know, just not cast themselves as a charity. They're mm-hmm. not, they're technically not a charity, and, you know, try to really sell books of poetry.
So Wave Books is a not, is
it's
not
for profit.
A not
right,
for
they're
profit.
A for-profit
but
enterprise.
That doesn't mean that they are breaking even or making money. I mean, they're doing very well in terms of what they're doing for the community, and they're publishing great books, and they're getting the books out there. But the other thing to remember is that when we're talking about 1,000 or 2,000 copies of a poetry book, those are similar numbers to what a large press poetry book, when there used to be poetry books on large presses, what they would sell. So, and the way that they may be able to afford to publish those books is because it's offset by their cookbooks and their, you know, Twilight or whatever they're publishing. So it's not, I feel like there's part of it about us casting ourselves in a certain way, and another part of it is simply just the numbers. Like if you're not inclined to try and model yourself after a larger press where you have these blockbuster books that subsidize the other ones, then you have to make up for it in other ways, which we all do. You know,
one distinction that I would make between what we do and a conventional per se publisher is that generally conventional publishers get money through their products, what we call, you know, through their books. They have a particular book that seems to connect with enough people to make it profitable.
Well, and, like Twilight.
Yeah. And but then it seems to me that independent publishers aren't really necessarily relying on the book that will sell through into the market, but rather are selling their identity, selling their culture.
Well, I
their
think
service.
That's particularly true for both Fence and Ugly Duckling. Not so true for Station Hill, that's been sort of in, you know, that's over the last 10 years or so, been more quiet.
But I think this goes back to also what does it mean to be independent or nonprofit, which are not synonymous, but they often go hand in hand. And the fact, I mean, just what Anna is talking about, that we, perhaps the one defining characteristic is that we do not make our editorial decisions based on on trying to subsidize other books, you know, the books that we know won't sell. Or, I mean, I'm sure some people do sometimes, but that's not our mandate. We are not beholden to anybody to do that.
Yeah, we have missions, and our missions are not to make money.
Yeah, our thing is...
In fact, our mission is to not make money.
I'm not sure, but our thing is we only publish the books that we love and that have to be printed. That's, you know, we have a somewhat extreme stance on that.
And a lot, and I think this is follows on what you were saying, but so therefore, I mean, the other question we ask what independent means, but what does publishing mean?
Mm.
And it's certainly not just producing a product. It's producing a product, but it's also making that product public, but it's also producing a public for that product in a way, creating a public.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I mean, publish means to make public, to bring to the people. And so
I think maybe we should all...
If one understands publishing from that standpoint, this medium that we're using now is a publishing enterprise, is a making public.
Yeah, I like the term broadcasting. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can just switch every kind of production of media can just be called broadcasting, because that includes then, I mean, I guess you're saying publishing does too, but I wanted us to talk a little bit about the channels that we go through to reach our audiences.
I would maybe quibble and say, I mean, one of our interests is sort of narrow casting.
You know, that's
I would
exactly
go back
what I was
to
gonna
sort
say,
of Jack Spicer's idea that, you know, poetry is a cult. I'm not sure I agree with that, but, you know, one can evoke Spicer, you know, when he speaks of poetry as being for very few people.
Yeah.
that idea of narrow casting also relates to this question of community and I guess, you know, within this publishing medium of radio or broadcasting, you know, this community into which we're speaking.
Well, I think
in a very weird
there's
in a room mics in our faces.
The first thought that came to my mind was narrow casting as well, in the sense that we can't afford and aren't inclined to spread, like, broadcast in the sense of, like, broadcasting seeds, like print a billion books and just sort of, like, see where they land in the world. Of course, we can't do that, and that would be wasteful, and that would not make any sense. So what we try and do at Ugly Duckling is the one sort of strategic decision we make is how many of a certain book to print. I mean, it's always pretty much in the same range. But you know, over the years, we've gotten to know sort of how many people tend to want to read our books. And we do a lot of translations, some from quite obscure languages. So we just get a sense of who the audience is. And we always print more than that because we want to expand the audience, but we don't print 10 times that.
Right. It's
you
like
can
there's some kind of
more.
Interesting, I want to use the word aporia, but I'm not sure it's correct, but between the notion of the focused audience that you are not necessarily, it's not like you know every person who will buy these books, but they are, you know, if you conceive of it as community, then you are trying to think of it as something that you know. That's not, you know, so broadcasting implies like I'm going to, you know, broadcast tiny seeds and see how many of them come up wherever they land. And that's, and so there's that. But so the question of expanding audience is there's some, I don't know, disjunction between the idea that you're always trying to reach more people.
I would pose it in another way. I'm reading an interesting book right now, Greenblatt's book, The Swerve. Have you read that? It's about
Lucretius. My parents have it.
Dead Natura Rerum, and, you know, of the nature of things. And this publishing event in the 15th century, not exactly publishing, but this copying event and this repeated copying event. So this, you know, Greenblatt poses that this one book was narrowly read at the time, but the effects of it are very deep, that they run deep. And so I think that to a certain extent, being independent publishers, part of our interest is to publish that one book, which will cause a swerve, which will cause a redirection. Because I think, as we know, some of the directions, you know, some of the grooves that have been laid out for us, for this country and really for this planet, are heading off maybe a precipitous, you know, running us toward a cliff. And we need a little bit of a swerve, I think.
Yeah. What I was thinking about is channels. What are these channels? What are these? How do we reach whoever it is that we're going to reach? I mean, literally and in the sense of just letting it happen? How do you let it happen? Mm-hmm. How do you?
One thing I would say, because I kind of clocked in with WGXC early, trying to raise money for them, and you know, have watched as it's evolved. You know, we talked a little bit before the show about this idea of community in the Mid-Hudson Valley. When we talk about a Mid-Hudson Valley community, it's a very diverse and sort of amorphous thing. Actually, WGXC creates community. It creates a center. You know, when you're in New York City, there's an immediacy and there's a togetherness because of just sort of geographic restrictions and so forth. And it's very easy to evolve a community. But here we're very disparate, very broad. But the WGXC actually forms the a center for where we are. And it's incredibly important.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And so all of you should call in and pledge. We'll just throw that in there.
Definitely.
So let's see, Anna, would you like to talk about any sort of local versus national kind of thoughts you have?
Well, I guess, you know, on a more mundane level, I can talk about our channels and how we do reach people, which does sort of address that. One of the things, I mean, there are so many presses in New York City, and we are based in Brooklyn, even though our large editorial collective is sort of spread all over the world.
Ooh, maybe, okay, maybe so we don't have to talk about mundane things. Maybe I just thought of what I wanted to say with bouncing off of what Sam was saying. So Sam's talking about the ways in which WGXC creates an epicenter, as it were, something for people to connect to. And I have personally witnessed how Ugly Duckling has functioned in that way as well, which I think has a lot to do with the fact that it is a collective and that it literally collects, you know, all sorts of different people come to it from different vectors or something like that. And so I recently attended an amazing, you know, party. It was a party. And there were probably 300 people there or something at a gallery for Ugly Duckling. And it was kind of awe-inspiring. And so maybe you could talk a little bit about the experience of being sort of how Ugly Duckling functions as a collector of disparate energies.
I don't know what the alternative would be given all the disparate energies that we have. Mm-hmm. So I don't totally know how to address that. I mean, I do know that we, despite the fact that we love the internets in that love-hate way that everybody does, and we are very, very supportive of all the outreach that we do in an impersonal, disembodied way. We also have always really privileged bodily contact with each other and with others. And from the very beginning, we took press road trips, like as if we were a band or something, and we would get in the car and we would go to some small town, some college town, kind of figure out a route, arrange readings, and literally, you know, go drop off our books at independent bookstores around the country, maybe host one of these anti-readings or have a reading with a local poet, an ADP poet.
Originally, was this just because you liked to spend time together as a group? And I assume you probably also found that it helped you to form new ideas and sort of bounce off each other and all that kind of stuff.
I think, yeah, all of those things. I mean, our main, you know, people sometimes make assumptions about Ugly Duckling because we use letterpress technology and we do hand binding and all these people sometimes make assumptions that we're Luddites or that we have a particular attraction to using old fashioned means. But actually, we've really made a lot of our decisions based on what we can do, based on expediency and fun. Mm-hmm. And so we had a car, or we had a couple cars between us, and getting in the car and going someplace was fun and expedient in the way that it is for people who are underemployed and in their 20s. So part of it was just that because we could, you know, who wouldn't want to go on a road trip and meet other poets in various random places around the country and see what they're doing. And we did get incredibly inspired. I remember going to Cincinnati, where Dana Ward, a wonderful poet, set up a reading for us. And it was really a highlight of our entire history as UDP. It was the UDP event at this gallery, I've forgotten the name of it, in Cincinnati, where none of us had ever been before. Mm-hmm. And it was an incredible turnout of mostly visual artists and great conversations. And, you know, those experiences have really, and they've continued, you know, they've become a little less frequent as we've gotten older and more settled, but they have continued. And the that those in-person things are really, really invaluable. And so we have also lots and lots of events. And since there are a number of us, we can manage to do that. And then we have a studio, which is large enough when we're actually about to move to a larger studio, brand new news. That's been really important to us too, ever since we could, to have a workspace that has a giant communal work table where we can welcome volunteers and just us, ourselves work. And that has sort of an open door to other people in the creative communities that we like to surround ourselves with, including especially visiting people from other states and other countries who will come and visit or help make their own books if we're printing one of their books or what have you.
I suppose in a way we're not reiterating, but just affirming the whole local, we're thinking locally, even though what we're producing is a distributable product that can fall into hands that we cannot know. Much like this broadcast, which I asked the station manager beforehand if she knew how many listeners there were, and she said, we have no way of knowing, ever. We never have a way of quantifying the number of listeners, which is kind of fascinating in a way.
It's amazing. There are so few things that are not trackable right
now. Yeah, but no, you're out there listening and nobody knows. It's a secret. So, but again, there's I guess, as publishers who are producing print objects still, we're compelled sometimes to make the production of it be the local aspect. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting what's going to happen, in relatively near term in terms of the book. This Codex form that we've been making books in for 500 years, 600 years. Now, what's going to happen in the next 10 years, 20 years, and how and to what degree is it going to merge with these other forms of publishing or casting? Yeah, we really don't know.
We cannot know. And with that, I'm going to thank my guests, Anna and Sam. Sam Truitt of Station Hill Press and Anna Moskovakis of Ugly Duckling Press, of Brooklyn and Barrytown, respectively. And, go pledge. Thanks.
Go pledge.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks,
always
Rebecca.
A pleasure.
Thanks, Stop it.
Stop.
So that was the...
Go pledge.
Thank you, Rebecca.
I want to go to Chelsea. Oh, no, it does not move me. Even though I've seen the movie, I don't want to check your pulse. I don't want nobody else. I don't want to go to Chelsea.